BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the novelist Helen Fielding. 25 years ago, she penned a fictional diary in the Independent newspaper, exploring the inner life and outer misadventures of an unhappily single 30-something. And so Bridget Jones, one of Britain's most memorable and successful comic heroines, was born. The weekly newspaper columns became a book, and Bridget Jones's diary was described by The Guardian as one of the 10 novels that best defined the 20th century. 3 more novels and blockbuster films would follow. Long before the age of social media, Bridget was gripped by self-doubt and status anxiety, though her metrics were calories and units of alcohol rather than likes and follows. Thankfully, the character's ability to make readers laugh has proved as enduring as her insecurities, something her creator considers crucial. The second of 4 siblings, brought up in Yorkshire, Helen's love of storytelling began when she was a child, saw her read English at Oxford and took her into journalism, working in TV at first before moving into print. She says, "I grew up with a real mixture of dark and light and work ethic and glamour, and that's informed my life." Helen Fielding, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Hello, it's such an honour to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for joining us from your home. We're not in the studio. So 25 years on since Bridget arrived on the scene, Bridget has endured. New readers are finding her all the time. I wonder what your feelings are about Bridget Jones today.
I feel very grateful to Bridget for what she's done for my life. And I feel very pleased that, in particular, young girls are still enjoying the book. I think what happened with Bridget really was that I wrote it so unselfconsciously that I wasn't thinking about how it would be received. And therefore, that freed me up to be very honest about what it is like being a human being, really. Mm. And I think it's that has resonated. I think the social circumstances surrounding Bridget then are different from now. I think it wouldn't have been possible to write it in that way now. Things have changed happily.
Why do you think it wouldn't have been possible? What's changed?
I took my kids to see a screening of the movie. I hadn't seen it for years and years, and I was staggered. You couldn't write that now. The level of sexism that Bridget was dealing with, the hand on the bum in so many of the scenes, Richard Finch, you know, let's have a shot at the boobs. I mean, in the end, she turned around and stuck it to them, but it was just part and parcel of her life. And it was quite shocking for me to see how things have changed since then.
Helen, we're going to hear your tracks today. How hard was it to get to
really,
your final 8?
Really difficult. For a start, I love self-help books. So my first list was a sort of musical self-help book, beginning with Climb Every Mountain. But then I tried to do what I was told and stick to records that made me think of specific moments or people or times.
Well, with that in mind, let's hear your first, shall we? This is disc number 1.
This is Fly Me to the Moon. I was brought up in a mill town where they made the cloth for donkey jackets for miners and steel workers. And it was all quite Victorian in a way, sort of chapel-y and dark. But my parents were really good at fun. My dad bought this Dormobile, and my mum used to put tins of food in it, like tins of Spam and things, all year. And then when it came to the summer, we used to get all fancy and go off to the continent. And she's quite old now, and she loves listening to old records. And when I played her this one, her face just lit up. So this is my first one. I also think it'd be lovely for me to dance around to on the island.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling. kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore.
Julie London and Fly Me to the Moon, taking you back to your childhood, Helen Fielding. So you grew up in Morley in West Yorkshire, the second of four children. Your dad, Michael, was a mill manager. Tell me a little bit more about him.
Well, he was the most lovely man. He was a really good man, very, very kind, very clever, very musical and terribly funny. Northern humour was a big thing in our house. It was all sort of Les Dawson and Morecambe and Wise. And really the essence of the joke was bringing the pretentious down to earth, really. And my dad used to spend a lot of time with me. He used to play snooker with me and tell me all about his business. In later years in the entertainment business and moving to LA, and all those good lessons about honesty and work relationships, I think were really useful. Mm. And our house was quite noisy, and everyone played musical instruments.
What did you play?
The violin, ghastly, and the viola, and the piano. So it was sort of terrible, really. There was sort of violins and trumpets, and then my dad got an organ. But it was a very happy family. They were quite glamorous as well, my mum and dad. My mum was really beautiful and they used to get all dressed up and go out to the Nouveau Club in Leeds. And my mum was really keen on food.
Yes, she had been a cookery teacher, is that right?
Yeah, she'd been a cookery teacher and she used to love making fancy food, rather like Bridget's mother, sort of meat with fruit, and then serve it in a hostess trolley. She was quite scatty like me. She set the kitchen on fire three times till my dad bought her a deep fat fryer. There's quite a lot of chaos.
So good at fun and glamorous, and your dad with this quite wry northern sense of humour. Were you good at making him laugh?
Yes, he liked my sense of humour and he was a lovely, gentle teaser. And he was very handy and practical, my dad, as well. He built our house that we lived in. I suppose they built it not that long after the war. And it was full of hiding places in case the enemy came, and it had a cellar with a generator that you could hide in. But he was always adding bits onto the house, very practical person.
It sounds like a gift for a child with a big imagination.
Yeah, I mean, there was always, both of them, mum and dad, there was always room for imagination. I had this set of plastic animals and I used to play with those on this fireplace in the hall and make up stories for them. So it was a house where there was room to be who you wanted to be, really. I was allowed to have this room and I painted it dark purple. And as I got into my teen years, I was doing a lot of writing of terrible poems and sort of listening to Cat Stevens and Leonard Cohen.
So your ambition to write came early?
Yes, it was always something that I felt I knew how to do. I knew my way around with words for some reason. It just felt easy.
It's time for disc number two. What's it going to be?
OK, well, this is The Windmills Off Your Mind by Noel Harrison. And it was one of the earnest introspective records that I was very keen on as a teenager. But I distinctly remember my dad. I can remember where he was when he listened to this. I can remember the wallpaper, which I think they thought was fancy. It was black with tropical fish on it. And he just thought this song was really funny because he said it was a pretentious rambling on the word round, and he'd never heard a larger collection of clichés, particularly the world is like an apple whirling silently in space. And he also thought it was like the machinations of my own mind, which was applying a great deal of thought to the wrong things.
Round like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a never spinning reel. Like a snowball down a mountain, or a carnival balloon. Like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon. Like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. And the world is like an apple, whirling silently in space. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Like a tunnel that you...
Noel Harrison and the Windmills of Your Mind. Helen Fielding, I've heard you describe life as a teen in 70s Morley as being about work ethic and glamour. And I want to start with the glamour, obviously. Where did one find that at that point?
We used to dress up a lot. And my mum used to go mad. I'd sort of wander around with a bare midriff and things like that. And we used to go out to nightclubs in Leeds. In fact, one time, horrifyingly, we went to a nightclub. My parents were there. It was awful. Sometimes just like parties in church halls and things like that. But it seemed glamorous to us.
What about the hard work? You had a secret ambition to go to Oxford. Did it seem like an achievable goal?
Well, when I was little, I was very clever at school and, you know, I used to do really well. And then it sort of went off the boil a bit. I used to be quite plain. I had winged glasses and sticking out teeth and plaits. And then when I was about 15, I got rid of the glasses and got contact lenses and my teeth were straight. And then I dyed my hair blonde. And then I became distracted from my studies for quite a period of time. But I did really want to go to Oxford. And then when they were asking everyone to apply, they didn't ask me at school because I'd sort of let things slide a bit. So then I decided I was really going to work. So I spent a whole summer working.
You made it to St Anne's College in Oxford in 1976, but apparently weren't happy at first. Why not?
Well, I wasn't unhappy. I was proud to be there, but I found it quite intense, given that we'd come from such jollity, really. And also, coming from the north, I wasn't really prepared. You know, even just silly things like dinner was at lunchtime. So the first time my tutor asked me for drinks before dinner, I turned up at 11:45. And then when I was invited to a dinner party, I went in a long dress and everyone was just in jeans having spaghetti. So there was a bit of adjustment like that. Mm. But I found some friends. And then I had this idea that I was going to be an actress. And I got a part in a play called Mad Dog Blues by Sam Shepard, playing Marlene Dietrich in fishnet tights, singing Falling in Love Again and doing a dance with a chair. And at the end of this performance, this posh boy came up to me and said, "I would like to be your boyfriend." And I was like, oh, it was Richard Curtis. He invited me out for lunch. And there was a whole load of these boys all living together in the house. And they were just really funny. They said they thought I was really sophisticated till I opened my mouth and this Yorkshire accent came out. They were good people and still are and really funny.
I think it's a perfect moment to hear some more music. What's it going to be?
Oh, yes. This is It Must Be Love by Madness. And it just reminds me of that lovely time in my 20s when I lived in Bristol. I worked for local news down there and then living in Camden Town, the big shared house with lots of people. And just really all the times of friendship that I've really enjoyed.
As soon as I wake up, every night, every day, I know that it's you I need to take the blues away. It must be love, love.
Madness and It Must Be Love. So, Helen Fielding, you'd fallen in with friends that you would keep for life, Richard Curtis. You were a couple for a time, and Rowan Atkinson. And they took you with them up to Edinburgh to take part in a review. How did it go?
Quite badly. I wasn't really very good at acting, and all my parts were taken away from me one by one, apart from Misguided, the mute chambermaid. And I ended up just being in Grimm's Fairy Tales. It was very sad. But so that was really the end of my acting career. It was blighted. They got successful very quickly. The gang grew to include people like Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson and the Cambridge people. And I wasn't really, I was always slightly part of it and not part of it, because when I left college, then I went to Bristol to work for the BBC.
Yes, you were making films for Nationwide and Play School, which hints at a very rich brief.
Well, then I moved to Play School after Nationwide. And that was a really great job. You got to choose which window to zoom in through.
You also made films for Comic Relief, which, of course, was created by Richard Curtis, on Ethiopia, mm-hmm. Sudan, Mozambique. What impact did that work have on you?
I think my 20s was quite an interesting time because it was very fun. But also it was a time when my father died when I was about 24 and life became a bit more serious for me and I became more interested in issues, if you like. Mm. I remember in 1984 when there was a famine in Ethiopia in Wallo and there was some extraordinary footage that came from the camp by Mohamed Amin, the cameraman. And then Michael Burke put on an extraordinarily beautifully written commentary about the light coming through at dawn and lighting up a famine of biblical proportions. So yes, I did go out at the start of that. And then, much as I loved play school and light entertainment and all that, I then decided I wanted to become a serious journalist, which of course I never managed. I've always ended up in the shallow end. But I decided I was going to make a documentary. There was this story about locust swarm in the Sudan, blotting out the sun, the teeth of the wind, they were called. And I managed to get Thames TV to say I could make this story. But then when I got there, the locusts had all flown off to Chad. And I remember the producer coming out and marching me along the banks of the River Nile saying, seldom has a story collapsed so dramatically. But then we went down instead to do the South Sudan War. And that was pretty dramatic. We camped on the border of Kenya and the Sudan. And then I was really cross because the crew set off without me to go and interview John Garang, the rebel leader. And they left me behind because I was a girl. And then they didn't come back. And I knew something had gone wrong. I went to bed that night, and then something made me at 3 o'clock in the morning get up and get dressed. And half an hour later, they arrived, and they'd driven over a landmine. And a soldier had been killed, and the producer had been killed. So it was very dark. Mm. And after that, I really felt I got a little bit close to the danger, and I should rein it in a bit. It wasn't really fair on my mum.
Yes, your mum, who had lost your dad around that time, quite unexpectedly.
Yes, it was an accident. So it was very hard. And one thing I've been thinking about a lot, actually, during this epidemic is how important it is to be able to say goodbye to someone when they die. And I wasn't able to do that with my dad.
Let's take a break to hear some more music. This is your fourth disc today.
This is a piece of music. It's quite dark and complicated, and I really like it. And I think it's one of the most difficult piano pieces there is to play. So I often listen to this. It's just a really good piece of music if you're in a certain mood.
Part of the first movement of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3, played by Denis Mutsuyev and the Mariinsky Theatre Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. So, Helen Fielding, you found a place at the Independent newspaper after going from job to job for a while in print journalism, and it was a pretty cool place to be in the mid-90s. How would you describe it?
It was very cool. It was very exciting working for the Independent on Sunday. I'd been really trying to get into journalism for a while. It wasn't easy, but it was a time when everyone was wanting columns. And Andrew Marr, the editor, and Charlie Ledbetter asked me to write a column as myself originally. And I said, no, but I'll make a character up. And I think it was a time when the image of the single girl in her 30s had not caught up with the reality of it. And I still would go up and see my parents, and somebody would say, oh, how's your love life, and when are we going to get you married off, and all that sort of thing. You know, I think most comedy comes out of quite dark things, and it was hard, and I think it still is hard for girls in their 30s.
So Bridget was born 28th of February 1995 with that now iconic photograph,
really?
Yeah, of Susanna Lewis with the cigarette and the wine glass. You were writing anonymously. It was unattributed at the beginning. It was interesting that you said, you know, the comedy of Bridget is underpinned by sadness, by darkness. What were you going through?
That's so funny you asking me that, because I always deflected any questions about myself. in relation to Bridget, and I always denied that she had anything to do with me. But of course, she was very close to me in some ways, but not in others. I was a single girl in London, and I was having a lot of fun. I had a group of friends very much like Bridget, my girlfriends, my gay friends, my married friends. I used to have dinners and try and cook. And I had several different boyfriends, all very gorgeous. It's amazing the number of people that lay claim to be Daniel or Mark, including Keir Starmer. But I am quite a private person. So it was quite startling that this little thing that I'd written suddenly became a big thing. But imagine what it feels like to write your sort of behind the curtain things of your life that you wouldn't particularly want people to know about, or feeling stupid about, and then suddenly finding it. Of all the things I've been trying to do, my serious book course celeb about celebrities and famine, and you know, my journalism, this thing that came from left of field became the popular thing.
And what does it feel like?
Well, on one level, it's the most brilliant thing that could have happened. For me personally, it was a little confusing that I suddenly had this alter ego that was sort of me and not me. People used to expect me to behave like Bridget, and still do, and I very often do. But it was kind of liberating as well, because it gives you the ability to laugh at yourself and also realise that it's not just you thinking these things. It's not just you questioning yourself or comparing yourself.
Helen, it's time to hear your next track. What's it going to be?
I suppose a big theme in my life has been travel. And I was thinking, when I was thinking about the desert island, I remembered, oh, I have been stuck on a desert island. I was with my friend Emma, and we were in Honduras, and we met these two diving instructors, and they took us diving, and then they said they'd take us to the original Robinson Crusoe island. And they got a fisherman to take us on a boat. And then a storm came, and the fisherman didn't come back, so we had to spend the night on the island in the rain. And we ended up sleeping on cardboard under a sort of hut. Anyway, this song reminds me of that particular night when we got stuck on the island, but also just the freedom of travel that I love so much, the sun and nature. But all those things are really important to me. So this is La Isla Bonita by Madonna.
Last night I dreamt of San Pedro, just like I'd never gone. I knew the song, a young girl with eyes like the desert. It all seems like yesterday, not far away. Tropical, the island breeze, all of nature wild and free. This is where I long to be, La Isla Bonita. And when the sun will play.
Madonna and La Isla Bonita. So, Helen Fielding, we talked about the people who loved Bridget and connected with her. Sadly, not everybody took to her so well. What did you make of the feminist critiques of the book at the time? Some thought that you writing as Bridget Jones was setting the cause back years. Others said that you offered a defeatist view of womanhood. What was your reaction back then?
I always hoped to stand like a great tree in the face of criticism, but of course it always gets to me because I'm a human being. But having said that, I did deliberately put the line in Bridget Jones, "There is nothing so unattractive to a man as strident feminism." I think in the knowledge that it might annoy some people. And I think at the time, Bridget actually said that being a feminist with a capital F was another thing that she felt she wasn't very good at. And I think what's great now is that feminism has sort of lost its capital F. And I think the fact that the book was written in with the plot of Jane Austen, so it had a happy ending and a romantic ending, was a bit of a red herring, because Bridget does not straightforwardly just want a man.
You say that feminism has changed now, it's different these days. Is your feminism different now?
I think it's a struggle. It's still a struggle. Why do I find this so difficult to talk about?
You know, what's interesting is that it is hard to talk about. And I think a lot of people find it hard to talk about and hard to define and describe.
Yeah, And I think it's something you have to be very careful talking about. That's the other thing. You have to be very careful what you say now. Mm. You know, anything I say about feminism, I'm just so aware of those women. You know, I'm a lone parent with two kids with all the privilege that I have. Those women, you know, with kids on their own, no money, you know, that's where the fight really is. And I think it's a bit of a red herring to get hung up about Bridget. And I think the way that Bridget operates is the way that your friends operate. And when you see your friends at the end of the day for a glass of wine, you do not go in and say, oh, I've been such a marvellous feminist. You go in and say, oh, God, you'll never believe what happened to me today. And then you support each other.
Well, on that note, it's time for some more music.
I couldn't go to a desert island without including this classic. This has been the soundtrack to so many brilliant nights with my girlfriends with far too much wine. It's very overblown, but it's completely fabulous. And I will dance around on the island pretending I'm in little shorts and roller skates, and it's I Will Survive.
Gloria Gaynor and I Will Survive. That is going to sound great on the desert island, Helen Fielding. So the film version of Bridget Jones's Diary was released in 2001, and it boasted the irresistible combination of Hugh Grant as Daniel Cleaver, Colin Firth as Mark Darcy, and Renee Zellweger as Bridget. And of course, the screenplay was by you, by Richard Curtis and Andrew Davies. How hard was it to turn the book into a film?
It was one of those incredibly passionate, chaotic, difficult, creative processes with a lot of people who knew each other very well and were very fond of each other. We all thought it was going to be a disaster. There was one point where one of the rough cuts, Hugh said it was like a third world documentary. And we were all sort of working on it, people in different cutting rooms. I was sort of shooting mock-ups in my house and putting music onto things. I put It's Raining Men on to the fight scene. Everyone was suggesting things, but everyone thought it was going to be a disaster. And then the first screening in New York, which I tragically was not at, everybody laughed, and it was miraculous, and it suddenly was liked. It was brilliant.
You left the UK in 1999 and met Kevin, your partner, Kevin Curran at the time, and he was a scriptwriter on The Simpsons. You met while promoting your book, and you'd go on to have two children together. You lived in LA. What did you make of Hollywood when you first set up home there?
It was a fantastic thing that happened with Bridget. And of course, I'd always had this thing from being little of if I was a writer, I could have a swimming pool. And I realised that for the price of a two-bedroom flat in London, I could actually have a house with a swimming pool. And I met Kevin and we were living the dream. I had an open-top car. I was friends with Carrie Fisher, who's just the most interesting, great person to know in Hollywood because she knew all the history and she was very astute about how to navigate it.
It's time for your next disc, Helen. What's it going to be?
This is the moment when I finally got the pool after all those years of trying to write. And I thought, I'm just so lucky. And it's I've Got the World on a String by Frank Sinatra.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song.
I've Got the World on a String, Frank Sinatra. Helen Fielding, you talked earlier about the death of your father, and in the past few years, you've lost Kevin, your children's father, and your good friend, Carrie Fisher, as well. When dealing with huge losses like that, what helps?
This sounds really corny, but to me, they don't go away. I'm not very deathy in terms of graves and things like that. They're still there in my mind and in spirit. And yes, it's part of the ride we're all on. And, you know, I think during the epidemic, I've felt it very keenly. I think so much loss around brings your own losses back and, you know, and just makes you feel all those people and all that sadness and pain. But, you know, life has its dark notes, life has its light notes, and I think I'm quite good at surviving and finding the joy and the fun as well as feeling the things that you feel.
You've spent 25 years intertwined with Bridget. How much have each of you changed, do you think?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think in the books, she's still essentially the same. But in that later book, she's a person who's lived a life and with all that goes with it. And I think me too, you know. I'm still full of thoughts going round and round like the windmills of your mind and still loving my family and my kids and my friends. And I think I've had to develop a resilience and I think I've learned to be contented. This has been a very strange time to live through. And I think we'll be much more appreciative of the basics. Sounds like one of the clichés my dad would laugh at.
Time for one more disc then. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is my cocktail song. It's Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered, Stan Getz and the Oscar Peterson Trio. And I suppose with all the trials and tribulations, I like to remember that I have actually had, even though it hasn't been a straightforward married life, it's been a very romantic life. And I think on the island I'd like to have a cocktail hour and perhaps make a little black dress out of a pirate flag. But also this reminds me of when the kids were little. And I was so happy to have my children. And I just love being a mum. And I've loved every stage of it. The babies and the toddlers and now the teenagers are so brilliant and funny. And I used to bath them and then put them in front of the fire in towels and play nice music to them, and this was one of the things I used to play to them.
Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered, Stan Getz and the Oscar Peterson Trio. So, Helen Fielding, it's time to cast you away to your desert island. We're going to give you the books to keep you company, the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible to take with you, plus, of course, a book of your own. What would you like to choose?
Well, it's very, very difficult. It's almost like choosing the songs. But I think I'll go with Pride and Prejudice because it is the perfect novel.
You can also have a luxury item to make your stay on the island more enjoyable.
No Mr. Darcy, I assume.
Sadly not.
OK, well, this is slightly cheating, but I'm going to have a magic tree, which is a fruit tree, but also has chocolate orange. And the sap is chilled white burgundy wine.
You get top marks for creativity. And finally, if you had to save just one of the 8 discs, Helen, which would you go for?
It would be It Must Be Love, the most important thing.
Helen Fielding, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island discs with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. As we leave Helen sipping her white burgundy and eating a chocolate orange, there's just time to remind you that both Hugh Grant and Colin Firth have been cast away. Hugh in 1995, and in 2005, Sue Lawley interviewed Colin. She asked him when he first got the acting bug.
About 5 years old, pantomime, infant school is somewhere in Essex, and I was Jack Frost, and it was a pair of silver satin pants, a blue satin sash, and portentously a billowing white shirt.
Were you a hit?
I was. I don't know if I've been as big a hit since. And that's when I got the bug. That's where I thought where the love and attention lies.
You remember recognising that at the time?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, there was nothing else that gave me that sort of praise, that level of approval.
Yes.
I didn't take kindly to being sent to school, to being sent into this rather cold environment where you're given lots of instructions and nobody loves you. You know, you're sort of on your own. I couldn't believe that I had to go back again the next day. I can remember that. I thought, my first day of school was over. Thank God that's over. Now I can get on with my childhood. And it was a horrible shock, day two. Suddenly, the environment of school warmed up around me.
But you liked the idea of storytelling as well, didn't you? You liked the business of narrative.
It's been absolutely what's driven me through life, I think. Even if you write a diary of what you did that day, suddenly your day looks different because it has narrative form. It has a kind of ending to it.
It's quite childlike, that, in a sense, though, isn't it? That enjoyment, that suspension of disbelief.
It's entirely childlike, and I think that the skills an actor has to have are childlike. I think unless you have that, you can't do it.
Colin Firth. And you can find both Colin and Hugh's editions of Desert Island Discs and over 2,000 more to listen to on BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. Do join us then.
Dr. Hannah Fry.
And I'm Dr. Adam Rutherford, and we present the curious cases of Rutherford and Fry, that's me and her.
Certainly do. And every week what we do, we take a listener question, an everyday mystery if you will, and we try and investigate it.
Using the combined powers of science, books and occasionally the internet.
Sometimes we just look it up. But anyway, we are back with a new series that's investigating queries like...
Why do our tummies rumble?
Can we make it rain?
And what exactly is the point of wasps?
What is the point of wasps?
It's the end bit, the other end of their faces.
Lols.
I was really pleased with that.
You can hear all the answers to these questions and more by subscribing to The Curious Case of Rutherford and Fry on BBC Sounds.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.